Okay, this is Michael O'Rourke interviewing Cal Kramer on September the 5th, 1996. Continuing. And you said you had three alternatives.
Yes.
What were the three alternatives again?
Was staying as a dairy and getting a lot bigger, or going into hog production and build a setup so you could produce a lot of hogs.
And you said you knew what that was all about.
And I thought I knew how to do that job. Mm-hmm. Or go into row crops. Mm-hmm. And row crops was the easiest to get into. It took the less money. Mm-hmm. And so I opted to go that way. Had a couple of good field men. One was Bob Schlegel that helped me, and Flavorland. And we went into strawberries and Chehalem berries and evergreen blackberries. And then a few years later, I went into beans and some of those kind of things. Mm-hmm. And of course, at the same time, well, I had never borrowed money from the bank, and it was going to take some money. And so I went to the bank to borrow some money. Had quite a time trying to get a credit rating, but I did get one. But one of the stipulations was that we keep a good bookkeeping system. And we had been messing around with a computer program that was on a mainframe. And so the bank required that we stay with that computer system for our bookkeeping.
Uh-huh.
And so this place has been, the bookkeeping on this place has been on a computer since 1964 or 3, somewhere in there.
Uh-huh.
And then when the IBM XT home computer came out, well, it had enough capacity to handle this bookkeeping system. So we were then the guinea pigs for 3 years for the development of the computer program that we're on now, and that is being sold by Doane's throughout the United States and Canada and Mexico. Huh?
Worldwide.
Yeah, worldwide, really.
Uh-huh.
And of course the...
Sold by Doane's, you said?
Yes.
And that's the name of the company that developed the
yes,
software?
Yes, and Doane's is a well-known company in agriculture for bookkeepings and a whole lot of other different kinds of services.
Uh-huh.
And they bought the system after it was developed. And it was developed here in Beaverton. Bob Oling from Salem was really the original person with it, and he still has his fingers in it a little bit, but he's of an age now that he doesn't want to do that.
But he had a business in Beaverton for computers?
Yeah, it was in Salem.
In Salem, okay.
And when we went to the home computer, then he formed a company and he brought two programmers in from Indiana, a man and a wife, to develop that program. Mm-hmm. And what's nice about it for us is that if we have a problem when we get on telephone, call Beaver. Mm-hmm. And, you know, those that bought the system in New York have to call Beaver.
And how was the guinea pig experience? Did you have any problems?
Or was it
pretty smoothly?
Oh, yes.
Oh, yeah?
Sally was the bookkeeper, and she learned to use the computer. And she had no outside training whatsoever. All her training was just strictly bookkeeping.
Mm-hmm.
And so she learned a lot, but you know, to try to clean a computer up at the end of the year and start over for the new year and some of those things got to be real buggers for us at times.
Uh-huh.
And we finally made it, but you know, we had lots of problems. And sometimes they had a bug, and we were the first to discover it. And so then they'd have to go back and redo their program and make corrections. We know what corrections and programs are real well. And you know, those discs would come in the mail quite often. Here's a change you got to make. So, but the first year it was strictly a labor part of the program. Then the next year was the general business part of it. And the third year was the enterprising.
Mm-hmm. So the first year it just kept track of your employment records,
right,
essentially.
Right.
And
We
had, and of course we kind of set the standards for the program. They wanted to know what we wanted for a program. Well, we wanted a program that could handle, you know, 200 kids. We wanted a program that if we changed the price of picking at noon, that the computer could handle that. Mm-hmm. And we wanted a program that could handle piecework, hour work, both.
Uh-huh.
And so we really put some pressure on those programmers to try to develop that. And of course, we wanted it so that when we pressed the buttons, well, pretty much automatically the parts, your Social Security and all that stuff would just come across automatically, do the deductions automatically, and so we didn't have to spend a lot of time at it.
Uh-huh. Right.
And so it was a challenge.
But you got it all worked out after
a
while.
Yes, we've got it, and we're real pleased with it.
I assume that you were, as guinea pigs, then you didn't have to invest a lot of money financially in this in those first years. Is that right? Or
we didn't pay it to those people, but there was an investment.
And a personal investment,
yes,
right here at home.
Yes.
And I assume you say that you sort of, made a lot of input in terms of the kinds of needs you had for that computer, but mm-hmm. I assume that those would be needs that any small farmer would have. Is that right?
A row cropper. Right.
Okay.
And see, that program is one like Malinsky's are using now with their plant over there, and they've developed that program not just for what we need, but they've got one for them that takes care of all the inventory, and when they take stuff out, well, it deducts it from the inventory and does all their special needs too.
Mm-hmm. Backing up just a little bit to when you took over the place from your dad and you farmed together that first year, was one of the reasons that you decided that you needed to take over on your own was because you wanted to try out some of these new approaches and new ideas? Was that part of the motivation, or why did you feel that one of you had to leave?
There just wasn't enough income.
Uh-huh, okay.
In the first year I took over, I bought the farm. I paid too much money for it. The gross income that first year was $8,000, and I had to feed 35 cows and a family of five.
Not 8,000. even back then, that was probably a challenge.
That was. Mm-hmm. But you know, my dad he didn't owe any money. He didn't pay no interest. And he kept the taxes up. His expenses were not very great. But someone that was buying a place, you know, those expenses, the fixed expenses, were double what he would have had.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, there's only one way to buy a farm, and that is you don't look at the land, but you look at the operation and how much money it can make.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how business looks at a business when they buy it, is not what the investment was that's sitting there, but how much money it'll make, and uh-huh, what's the net.
Uh-huh. Right, can you service the the debt with the income?
Yeah.
Huh? Yeah.
Those are things you learn later on.
I'm wondering, when you made that decision to to sort of shift the operation. Well, actually, before you did that, you decided to expand the farm somewhat, right? You went from, 22 head or something up to 35 head of cows.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I packed a cow in every place I could put one. And we went to a loaf and shed style setup also, and where the cows were loose at night and during the day, and so I was able to use some of the outside buildings that hadn't been used before.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And you said to begin with, you kept up the relationship with the dairy here in in Forest Grove, was it?
Yes, and then I changed. I had Guernseys, and I had an opportunity to go into Portland to an all Guernsey organization that shipped and sold all Guernsey milk. And so I think that was, or did we go to another place before that? Yes, I think that's right. I think we were with Mayflower, the co-op first, from Guyton's to the co-op and then to the all Guernsey deal.
Uh-huh.
And there was a little more money in the all Guernsey thing.
Uh-huh. Is Guernsey milk then, does it have better quality than?
I've been out of it so long, I'm not sure I want to even get involved in that one.
Okay.
It's a loyalty thing.
Okay, I see.
Yeah. Go talk to Pete Jansen. He'll tell you how good it is.
Okay. Now, when you made the decision to switch to row crops, did that then change the irrigation demand that you had here?
Oh, yes. Uh-huh. Oh, yes.
And what you
couldn't make near as many mistakes.
Uh-huh. And did you have sufficient water or rights to sufficient water?
No. No. And there was one time I was raising cucumbers. I had cucumbers in this field right by this house. We went 5 weeks without water, and that's too long for cucumbers. And so we were really short on water.
Did you lose that crop then? Or?
It was very short. Mm-hmm. And so when they started promoting the development of the Hague Lake and that, well, I participated in that and supported it mm-hmm. from the very beginning. Mm-hmm. Now, it began technically, I believe, in 1935 to develop the river for irrigation, but it never really got going until after World War II, and of course, I think the dam got in 1974.
Right.
Yeah. And so in that late 60s, early 70s, well, we learned to be very good irrigators.
Uh-huh.
And even the state of Oregon now, the water resources people, don't even want to discuss on how much water we use to irrigate our crops, because everybody is so darn careful that they don't over-irrigate that.
Uh-huh. And so where would you get your water in those years? Still from the river?
Still from the river, mm-hmm. yeah. And there were a few wells that developed, but mm-hmm. we don't have a lot of wells in this county.
Now, but did you have a right then to water from the river at that point? Or
I got the first water right in 57.
Uh-huh.
And of course, this bottom one has this, I think it's a 32 or 33 water right.
Uh-huh. I see.
But, you know, when the river's dry, it don't make any difference how good your water right is.
Right. There's no water, there's no water.
Yeah. Yeah.
And how did you get the right in 57? Was that difficult?
No, it wasn't. It was a matter of getting an engineer and meeting the requirements of the Water Resources Department for your permit. Mm-hmm. And I did that, and eventually it was certified.
Mm-hmm. Now, back in those days, or maybe even earlier than this time, I guess there were a lot of farmers that I believe just would take what they needed from the river without necessarily paying too much attention to regulations, etc. I mean, wasn't there sort of a laissez-faire attitude towards water on the Tualatin back before it became a real scarce commodity?
Mm-hmm. I don't know a lot about somebody stealing water or irrigating what he wasn't supposed to. I do know that in those 1948 and 1942 water rights that there was kind of a standard volume that was approved. And the law now is 6/10 of a cubic foot per minute per acre? Or no, 6 gallons, I don't know, something like that. But at that time, they were talking about a cubic foot or 2 or 3 cubic foot, per acre, you know. It was a big volume of water that their permits were allowed.
Uh-huh.
And of course, as they expanded, well, they went on to new acres, and some of them didn't apply for those new acres of permit, but they weren't exceeding the volume of their old permit. Now, my 57 right, well, I was given the opportunity to develop at that bigger amount, but I didn't. And the certificate was only approved for the amount that my pump would pump and the equipment I had to distribute it, which was a lot less than those original permits.
I see. And that's something probably that didn't work out too well a few years after that. Huh?
Well, I wish that I'd developed it further than I did at that time. But.
Mm-hmm. Now you said also, you just touched on it briefly when we were talking earlier about the problem that was beginning to build on the Tualatin in terms of water quality. You even mentioned that mm-hmm. there was some question about irrigating crops with
right.
that water. And you said that there was a real problem with all the outfalls on the river. Can you mm-hmm. tell me a little bit more about that?
Well, I knew we didn't irrigate Saturday and Sunday because Forest Grove held their raw sewage till Friday night and then dumped it.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. And it took till Sunday afternoon for it to get by here.
Uh-huh. You could actually see it in the river?
Oh, yes. Yep, there was no doubt about it.
How did it affect the river?
Oh, it gave it flow.
Oh, okay. So it's the fact that there was actually some water there.
Yeah, it was actually that there was something there you need to pump. Otherwise, there wasn't.
Mm-hmm.
And so you had a choice of what you wanted to do. And of course, the old water commission put a stop to that. And
put a stop to what?
To dumping. And then they started treating it tertiary, and we got a better quality water. And they dumped then on a continuous basis.
I see.
Mm-hmm. And those below Hillsborough, those irrigators really didn't run out of water, even in those short years. A little bit, but not too bad.
And that was because of this Hillsborough.
Because of Hillsborough and like the Tualatin golf course down at Tualatin, it's never run out down there. But they've had that where Lake Oswego puts that dam in every spring, and they back the water all the way up to Farmington. Well, they've always had water.
Mm-hmm. From Farmington on down. Huh?
Yes.
Uh-huh.
And there isn't that many acres to irrigate down there.
Mm-hmm.
So.
And there were a lot of, I guess, other outfalls too besides Forest Grove.
Oh, yeah.
Small and big.
Yes. Yeah. Well, Cornelius had their own, and Hillsborough, and then down the river, of course, Tigard and all those others too.
Mm-hmm. Did you see, besides the increased flows when they'd open the gates at Forest Grove, did you see other signs on the river like algae growth or you know?
Okay, we don't have algae growth up here.
Okay.
Because we've got enough fall in the river, it keeps it moving.
Uh-huh. Okay, and, so it moves a bit faster up here.
Right. Where it stops moving too fast is at Dairy Creek. And if you float the river from here down to Jackson Bottom, well, just before you come to Dairy Creek, well, you get into quite a ride. And it's, I don't know, I would guess a 2 or 3 foot fall right in that point right there.
Oh, yeah.
And, but then from then on, it really slows down. And part of it is that rock outfall there at Farmington that blocks it.
Uh-huh.
And so there's a natural dam there that kind of backs it up into Jackson Bottom. And if you get real involved geology of the Tualatin River, well, it's kind of understandable about Jackson Bottom and some of these other places because of the terrain and like Jackson Bottom, well, you got Dairy Creek coming in there with a lot of silt and a naturally big place to take on a lot of flood water, but at Farmington is that natural dam. Mm-hmm. And so it holds all the water back there, but then below the Farmington, well, it doesn't flow all that bad, although the people down there that I've talked to say, well, there's some natural holes down there that are 20 feet deep and that's well below the line that really flows, you know, and so those are just stagnant holes. Mm-hmm. In the river down there. Mm-hmm. But up here we've always had quite a bit of flow and there's never any water held back.
So algae's not a problem.
No, as long as you got moving water, well, you don't have much algae.
Right. But any other signs of the high nutrient content in the water up here?
Or not really.
Not really.
No.
So it's just knowing that Forest Grove is dumping the sewage and it might cause you problems.
Yes, that, and of course, I've been so involved in through the conservation district with the water quality problem then. Being that I was on the conservation district board for 20 years, well, we've got real involved in the water quality because it has the responsibility to agriculture.
Mm-hmm. Now, I suppose individual farms too have their own impact on the river, depending upon how people took care of their waste and the kind of farming they did. Can you tell me anything about the way practices have changed from, say, the early days when there weren't really any restrictions on a farm to what you have to worry about now?
There's a few changes, but boy, it's tough. There's some of us that were aware of it. We haven't used a plow in this place, well, a couple times in the last 15 years. Mm-hmm. We've gone to a chisel plow. Been leaving our stubble stand over the winter, and we cover crop. And, you know, there's... The chisel plow has come on.
And what's the advantage of the chisel plow?
Well, it leaves most of the trash on top. Mm-hmm. Of the soil.
I see.
And most of the row croppers have been chisel plowing. Mm-hmm. And some of the wheat people or general farm people are starting to now also. Mm-hmm. But, you know, to farm through trash is a challenge.
Uh-huh.
And that's what you end up doing.
Uh-huh. So it leaves a lot of this vegetable matter, stubble, et cetera, just chopped up on the top.
Is that right. And sometimes it's not too chopped up. But we've learned to do some things that lets us direct seed our broccoli and some of those things, even though we don't plow.
Uh-huh.
Of course, with 120,000 seeds to the acre and direct seed and plant to population, well, that takes quite a planter.
Uh-huh.
Because you're asking that planter to pick up one single seed and drop it. And on broccoli, you drop it 6 to 8 inches. And then that little seed, you want it about 1/4, 3/8 of an inch under the soil, and no further, and no less. And then you've got all this trash. So those are the challenges that we've accepted and have done a pretty good job of meeting. We've discovered that cover crops and flood ground is very beneficial. The Tualatin River is just naturally flows a lot of sediment. I claim it comes from the forest lands. Of course, the foresters say it's all from agriculture. But anyhow, with a cover crop, well, we can collect about 2 to 3 times as much of that sediment in our bottom ground as you can without it.
Uh-huh.
And so, and our bottom grounds, most of them are highly organic. And so they actually go down in elevation because of the organic deterioration when you farm it.
Mm-hmm. And you say bottom ground, you mean the lower areas?
The floodlands.
Yeah, okay.
Mm-hmm. So with the row crops, we actually were able to maintain our elevation in our low floodplain rather than lose it.
Mm-hmm. And how would you lose it? Due to erosion or?
No, to the deterioration.
Oh, I see.
Yeah.
I see. The organic process.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Let me just pause here. One more word here on the tape. Well, I guess we're getting up to our quitting time here, but I want to thank you for a good start on this interview, Cal, and we'll continue it. It's a great story.
Okay.